probably the only place they're going to be able to cut is service at this point. You know, that's unfortunate. But the union's not asking for more money.
State ferry workers consider authorizing a strike. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers debate how closely the state should be aligned with the oil companies.
They're our partners. We are partnering with Exxon in the pipeline. The adversarial role that we have with them, we have to get rid of that. We have to stop that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at FNBAlaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Contract talks between the state and Alaska's ferry workers are heating up as each side disagrees on how to make up the gap between revenues and the cost of operating the ferry system. Workers are now considering whether to authorize a strike if negotiations remain stalled. Margaret Friednauer of Station KHNS has more.
More than 600 ferry workers with the state's Alaska Marine Highway System are represented by the Inland Boatmen's Union. This week, the union's negotiating team sent out a letter encouraging members to approve a strike authorization ballot. Approval of the ballot doesn't mean a strike is guaranteed, but it does give the union leverage and the ability to call a strike if a stalemate in negotiations continues. Kerry Crocker is the chairman for the Alaska region of the Inland Boatmen's Union. He says the union is hoping to get at least 80% of its membership to authorize a strike.
It's a mail-in vote, and we'll go boat to boat to make sure that everybody votes.
The ferry workers' current contract expires on June 30th. The state is arguing marine highway operating costs far exceed revenue generated by the system, and so the state wants to find ways to save money in the ferry workers' contract. Negotiations are at an impasse over one issue: how much future ferry workers should get in a cost of living allowance. Right now, ferry workers get between a 15 to 20% cost of living adjustment. That's the highest cost of living adjustment of any sector of state worker, according to the Department of Administration. The state is proposing reducing the adjustment to 5% for ferry workers hired after July 1st. Curtis Thayer is the commissioner of the Department of Administration. He says that would bring ferry workers' cost of living adjustment more in line with other state employees and likely keep the Marine Highway from having to cut services.
From the state's perspective, we need to look at cost savings, and we've identified the cost of living differential where we can keep all the employees whole that are employed today, but in the future, changing that, which provides a cost saving to the state of $600,000 to $800,000 a year, and that is enough money to prevent us tying up a boat or reducing service.
Crocker says the union would agree to no pay raises for 2 years if the state would agree to leave cost of living adjustments alone. He says the union recognizes there are funding challenges for the system, but says the state needs to figure out how to more efficiently operate the ferries without reducing employee benefits.
But a lot of it's fluid. The ships are old, and I understand they, you know, unexpected costs come up all the time. Probably the only place they're going to be able to cut is service at this point. And that, you know, that's unfortunate. But, you know, again, the union's not asking for more money.
About $3.5 million was cut from the Marine Highway System's budget last year. The current budget before the legislature includes another $3 million in cuts. Crocker and Thayer said no new dates have been set for sit-down negotiations, but more are expected before the June 30th deadline. Thayer said it's possible the two sides will need to call in a federal mediator to help. IBU members have until May 25th to return their ballots about the strike authorization. Crocker said the ballots will be counted the next day to determine if the negotiating team has the support of membership to call a strike if they think it's necessary. Reporting in Haines, I'm Margaret Friednauer.
The Alaska legislature today confirmed a controversial appointee to the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation Board of Directors, but not without debate over whether he has Alaska's interests at heart. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Governor Sean Parnell's choice of Richard Rabinow drew criticism on two fronts, that he's not Alaskan and that he spent a career at Exxon. Senator Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat, questioned his allegiances.
Exxon's already got 25% of the line. I don't think they should get 20% of the public board positions on the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Mr. Rabinow's work history is nearly exclusively with Exxon. Indeed, 34 years with the company. 34 years.
Rabinow, a Texan, is a former president of Exxon's pipeline subsidiary, and he now works as a consultant on pipeline projects. The AGDC board is positioned to oversee a multi-billion dollar natural gas project, and service on the board is unpaid. Underlying the debate over the appointment is the larger question of how closely aligned the state should be to its dominant industry. Representative Charisse Millett, an Anchorage Republican, says it's time to get closer.
They are partners. We are partnering with Exxon in the pipeline. The adversarial role that we have with them, we have to get rid of that. We have to stop that.
Like other proponents, Millett says Rabinow's experience is invaluable to the board.
It's tough to feel that we're hiring an outsider to come in and help us, but I want the best. If I'm going to have brain surgery, I'm not going to go to the guy who maybe has done it once or twice. I'm going to go to the guy who's done it 120 times, 130 times.
Lawmakers voted 43-17 to confirm him. Senator Bert Stedman of Sitka and Representative Tammy Wilson of North Pole were among the few Republicans who voted no. The legislature also voted 45-15 to confirm former ConocoPhillips executive Bernie Washington to the board that sets the value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline for tax purposes. The critics, mostly Democrats, said Washington's previous work winning favorable tariffs for the oil company left him with divided loyalties. Washington is now the chief financial officer of APRN's parent company, Alaska Public Media. Journalists within Alaska Public Media objected to his service on the state board, too, due to concern it creates the appearance of a conflict of interest for the news organization. In Juneau, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Governor Sean Parnell has signed a bill that restricts state Medicaid payments for abortions. The new law puts a set of recently adopted regulations into statute and then takes them a step further. It specifies that the state will not pay for elective abortions. It also limits the term medically necessary to cases where a woman's life or physical health is at risk. The regulations had included a mental health exception. The new law is expected to be challenged in court. Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union are already suing the state over the existing regulations, arguing they violate the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. Last year, the state's Medicaid program covered about a third of the 1,500 abortions performed in Alaska. The Alaska State House has approved a deal to give the state's refineries and one fertilizer plant up to $200 million in subsidies spread over 5 years. The plan was introduced by Governor Parnell, and it comes in response to the closure of the Flint Hills oil refinery. It originally applied to the PetroStar refineries in Valdez and North Pole and the Tesoro refinery in Kenai, but was amended yesterday to include the shuttered Agrium fertilizer plant in Nikiski. The bill allows each of those facilities to secure an annual tax credit or payment of $10 million a year if they spend $25 million on tangible assets. Supporters of the bill argue it's necessary to keep the refineries running because of the jobs they provide and their importance to the state's military bases. But some Democrats have characterized the bill as a bailout, and they unsuccessfully tried amending it so the money would be given out as loans instead. The bill passed today on a 35-5 vote. It still needs to be approved by the Senate. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a tour of an Only in Alaska manufacturing operation.
Everything you see that Nomar makes is an idea that a local or Alaskan came and said, hey, I need this.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A new study shows lake trout in the Lake Clark National Park and Preserve have mercury levels that exceed the state and national standards for consumption by women and children. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The testing of the fish was part of a study conducted by the U.S. Geological Survey and the National Park Service. The study was specifically focused on fish in remote, high-elevation lakes and streams in 21 national parks across 10 western states and Alaska. Mercury was found in fish taken from 4 national parks in Alaska and some of the fish in the Lake Clark National Park and Preserve and the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve had mercury levels that exceeded the thresholds recommended by the state of Alaska and the EPA for unlimited human consumption by women and children. Morgan Worthen is the communications director for Alaska National Parks.
At Lake Clark National Park and Preserve, what we found was that there were high levels of mercury that were found in Lake Clark, specifically in lake trout.
The average concentration of mercury in the lake trout tested from Lake Clark was 365 parts per billion. The state of Alaska human consumption thresholds start at 150 parts per billion. The lake trout tested from one lake in the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve had average mercury concentrations of 417 parts per billion. Worthen confirms that the new study tried to determine the origin for the mercury detected in lake trout.
As we know, mercury comes from both natural sources like volcanoes, but also human-caused. And what we know is that it's also a global contaminant, so it travels in the atmosphere. And what the study suggests or states is that the majority of the mercury is coming from human-caused sources.
Lake trout are at the top of the food web and are relatively long-lived, which means they are more likely to accumulate mercury and other toxins over their lifespan. Worthen says the lake trout from Lake Clark are not consumed in large quantities, but she notes that the Park Service will have some advisories to guide anglers about whether or not the trout they catch is safe to eat.
Alaska National Parks are working closely with the state of Alaska to develop those advisories, so they are under development at this time. Our intention is to get that information up and available soon.
The other two national parks in Alaska where mercury was detected in fish were the Denali National Park and Preserve and the Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. However, the study found that the mercury levels in those two parks were low. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Alaska Inuit Circumpolar Council met in Nome this week to define food security from an Alaska Native perspective. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Carolina Behe is the ICC Alaska Traditional Knowledge and Science Advisor.
When we say food security, again, we're talking about the entire environment, right? And there's so many changes occurring within that.
As those changes occur, Behe says, Alaska Natives want a role in the decision-making. But she says their voices are often not being heard and their participation often excluded.
So if there is a lack of sea ice, if all of a sudden a new regulation is imposed that limits their accessibility to getting a food resource, they're not involved in making a decision that caused the impact of the environment or that resulted in the adaptation that people think need to take place for us to control the environment.
Behe says creating this definition helps communicate an Inuit understanding to outside bodies, like government agencies and development corporations. Education was also a major focus, particularly in teaching young people about subsistence. Behe says failing to transfer this knowledge threatens food security by limiting accessibility and altering identity.
Inuit are part of this ecosystem, and their culture has evolved because of this ecosystem, and this ecosystem has reacted to that. It's not static, it's continuously changing, and there's continued adjustments. But at this point, there's a lot of outside interest, and it's causing an increase in concern over food security.
The Alaska ICC is planning another meeting in Bethel later this year. They've already held two sessions in Barrow and Kotzebue. The gathered information will be peer-reviewed and then distributed to tribal councils, industry and government agencies, and the International Arctic Council. Reporting in Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Alaska Pacific River Forecast Center predicts the Kuskokwim will break up at Bethel between May 9th and May 15th. That range is right around the historical average of May 12th. But after a warm winter with little snow, the Forecast Center says this year's breakup could bring some flooding. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Selena Van Broecklin is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. She says her team is looking at two different scenarios. The first is a traditional breakup that's based on snow melting upriver. The Kuskokwim snowpack is less than half of normal levels at this point. If the river breaks up in the traditional way with little snowmelt in the pipeline, the ice upriver could have trouble floating and lead to flooding.
Because the water level is so low, there's not enough depth to get the ice sheets downstream, and they get caught in the bends in the river, and they get caught in the low spots in the sandbars. That's exactly what happened to Crooked Creek in 2011.
Van Broecklin says thanks to warmer than normal temperatures, that could lead to an earlier than normal breakup. The second scenario is a thermal breakup or mushout. That happens when the sun degrades the ice and there's not enough water to push ice downriver.
That could lead to a later than normal breakup in the sense of it just sits in the river and it just takes time for the sun to work on it before it finally moves out.
Ice thickness is currently a little below normal to normal. Measurements from earlier this month show ice 44 inches thick at Aniak, 34 inches at Napaimute, and 25 inches at McGrath. In any case, the conditions over the next 2 weeks will in part determine what kind of flood risk residents of the Kuskokwim will face.
It's easy for people to say, oh, there's a very small snowpack. We can see that the ice is already starting to deteriorate. But people should still be aware of the potential for breakup flooding, just for the reason that if there isn't as much water to push on the ice sheets, they do tend to ground, and we could still see some flooding from that. So still be aware and be prepared.
Van Broecklin will be part of the 2014 River Watch program, a partnership between the state and the National Weather Service to assess flood threats and navigational hazards. They plan to begin flying upriver around May 3rd, while a second team flying from Bethel could start around May 8th. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The Ketchikan School Board adopted new administrative regulations last week governing student nutrition and physical activity in order to meet new federal standards. The standards essentially require that only healthy food be served in schools. There are some exceptions built in, and the Ketchikan School Board added a few more, including the cupcake clause. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
The nutritional guidelines are part of the federal school lunch program standards, but reach beyond lunch. They include vending machines, concessions, and school activities, including classroom parties and fundraising. Those last two areas raised some concerns and led to a couple of language changes in order to relax the rules a little. One of the issues was selling food at athletic competitions that take place during the school day, such as the recent regional basketball tournament. Many non-students attend those activities and, as board member Stephen Bradford points out, want their snacks during a game.
And I think that we can do that by amending line 263 to add the words after sold or served, add the words directly to KGBSD students. In other words, they can still operate the concession stand. Old guys like me can still go in and enjoy my popcorn and Coke while I watch the basketball game. We will just have to put a note up for our own students that says you can't buy anything until 30 minutes after this instructional period is over.
That amendment passed unanimously, as did Bradford's second suggestion, which provides an exception to the healthy food standards for special occasions. Here's a little of the discussion between Board President Michelle O'Brien, Board Member Dave Timmerman, and Bradford.
So the amendment would be to line 297 and 298, traditional or cultural foods may be exempted from the food standards described above for educational or special school or classroom events when offered free of charge. Is there any discussion? Dave?
So does that cover cupcakes?
Well, I believe that a cupcake is, in our culture, is a standard item to be offered at a birthday.
Student board member Evan Wick suggested a third amendment to the guidelines. He notes that the rules prohibit any kind of educational material or school display that includes a name brand of an unhealthy food.
I've brought with me some educational materials. This is my AP World History book. It has a picture of McDonald's in it. The McDonald's would fall under the brands or illustrations of unhealthful foods. If I could draw your attention to another piece, this would be categorized as an illustration. This is in the K-High Commons. It's a mural by Ray Troll. It features a Burger King soda, a fries, and appears to be a cheeseburger, which I do believe probably falls under unhealthful foods.
As the student representative, Wick isn't allowed to make motions, but he asked the school board to consider amending the regulation, adding the words within reason. Board member Trevor Shaw complied, and the amendment passed unanimously. The main motion also passed without dissent. Approving it means that the district's policies now are aligned with the 2010 federal Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Nomar Manufacturing in Homer has been churning out gear for fishermen, hunters, oilmen, and outdoor enthusiasts for more than 35 years. The company was recognized for its work a few weeks ago when it was named Alaska Manufacturer of the Year by the Made in Alaska organization. KBVI's Aaron Selbig recently took a tour of Nomar's facility in downtown Homer and has this story.
You're Aaron.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. You're fine.
Are you must be Kate?
I'm Kate.
Kate Mitchell is co-owner of Nomar. Now tell the truth, when you think of Nomar, what do you think of? Probably a big retail store, right?
It's true. It's what most people think Nomar is. The jackets, the fleece jackets, bags, evolved from, hey, people need this stuff. So everything you see that Nomar makes is an idea that a local or Alaskan came and said, hey, I need this. And we made a prototype. We took care of that customer. But if it was something that was good for everybody who lives in Alaska, pretty soon it was on the shelf.
Nomar does carry products from other manufacturers, things like smart wool socks and MSR camping gear. But the vast majority of the stuff for sale is made on site. The shop carries heavy-duty gear bags, specially designed for workers on the North Slope, jackets and vests made just for commercial fishermen, and even a waterproof shotgun scabbard inspired by duck hunters at the head of Ketchumak Bay. The heart of Nomar lies beyond the retail store, in the back where an enormous manufacturing plant takes up most of the building. Employees here are hard at work, stitching, sewing, and cutting a wide variety of products. The company's bread and butter product is probably the Brailler bag, an innovative idea that began in the early 1980s when a couple of Bristol Bay fishermen complained to Kate Mitchell that the nets they were using to deliver product to the processors were making marks on the fish.
They were marked with that webbing, that net, and the processors were giving them a reduced price for every one of those fish. So it started off pure dollars and cents. We need something that doesn't mark the fish, and yet we can quickly deliver a load of product.
The mesh bags are built tough and built to last. They come in various sizes, some of them capable of holding more than 2,000 pounds of fish, and each one has a set of loops on the top that allow it to be picked up by a crane. The name Nomar, in fact, sprang from the Brailler bag, which leaves no marks, Nomar, on the fish. The bag was an instant hit and took Nomar in an entirely new direction, from a boat-top shop to a full-fledged manufacturing plant. Kelly Summers is busy putting together a Brailler bag in anticipation of the upcoming fishing season.
It's got several layers of sewing on these seams because of that picture. I love that picture. I keep that by the machine so that it reminds me how many pounds of fish those guys are around. You don't want anything busting on them, and you don't want the handles breaking on them. So he gets two entire layers of super thick thread. I mean, we could make something for you out of this, and you could hang, you could walk on this, couldn't you? This, it doesn't break. He gets a lot of stitches.
Summers is an experienced seamstress who's been here at Nomar for the last 4 years. She's one of 15 local workers who are employed here year-round.
There are those businesses that hire in the spring and then lay off, and I was raised in a family that, you know, you work for somebody, you work for them year-round, and we've developed this business to be a year-round, permanent.
Despite its massive 7,500-square-foot presence on Pioneer Avenue downtown, Nomar sprang from the humblest of beginnings.
Business started in a 1952 GMC school bus, because in those days we were Coast Guard, we were new to town. I knew we wanted a sewing business, and no one had a space that they would rent to a transit, you know, person.
That town was Ketchikan, and the year was 1976. 2 years later, Kate's husband Ben was transferred to the Cutter Hickory, and the family, along with their business, resettled in Homer. After a while, it was time to move on to bigger and better things, so the school bus became a dirt floor Quonset hut, and then the dirt floor Quonset hut became the state-of-the-art facility you see today.
In the end, we ended up with 7,500 square feet of building with concrete floor, two bathrooms, because out on Ketchmack Drive, we had an outhouse, and so this was going uptown.
Big time.
Big time. Big time.
Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with former Google Energy Policy Executive Dan Riker on Friday, May 2nd during the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena'ina Center. Hear how Alaska can become a world leader in the fast-growing renewable energy industry. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.